The election of Barack Obama as president in 2008 represented a big turn for America, the first time we'd elected a leader with any African roots. For some people, it was a sign that we'd turned a corner, that America was getting past the politics of race. The enthusiasm has clearly waned a bit since then. Today's guest looks back in American history to the issue of race and how it has been handled by individuals and groups. Her book is called A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. Jacqueline Jones is the author. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas in Austin, with a couple of longer titles indicating which history professor she is. She's won several awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship and the Bancroft Prize for American History, and is the author of seven previous books. Jacqueline Jones, thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
So in your intro, you say the American creation story begins with a violent, self-inflicted wound. What is that?
That is the institution of human bondage, which marked the British American colonies really in the 17th century, but took force especially in the 18th century. It's an institution, of course, that seems to go against all that the United States stands for, a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. We have to reconcile those high-minded sentiments with the reality of human bondage.
Do you think we've gotten to a point in our history now when we can actually talk about it in such frank terms? Because it seems like when we do talk about the great founding fathers and all the wonderful things that were done in creating the American Republic, and there were many wonderful things, obviously, that there's often been a glossing over or just like, let's not talk about slavery now sort of attitude.
Yes, I think so. I think certainly there is this notion that the founding fathers created an enduring republic. They were brilliant men, brilliant thinkers. The fact that many of them, especially those from Virginia, were slaveholders is often presented as an afterthought, when in fact that is a central fact of our founding. And what I point out in the book is that the word race is problematic because people of African descent were exploited for their labor, not so much because they were a different race, but because they were particularly vulnerable in America. And they were seen to be efficient, cheap laborers because of their vulnerability, because they did not come under the purview of English law, because they were not could not be rescued by a seafaring empire, which certainly made a big difference in the Atlantic world of the 18th century. So it's a complicated story, but we have to remember that race is a myth, that significant, substantial differences among humans based on racial characteristics is not true. And that this story of racial difference has been used to exploit a particular group of people over time.
The myth of race is a provocative term, obviously. Was it anything that you agonized over at all, or was it something that was pretty easy to just say, hey, let's call a spade a spade? So, oh, boy, that was the worst thing I could have possibly said. Sorry.
I think I need to make a very clear distinction here. The myth of race has left us with horrendous legacies. The fact that people throughout American history have invoked this notion of racial difference, the idea that people of a certain group are very different from people of another group, that has left a bitter legacy. I don't want to minimize that legacy. And in fact, in my epilogue, I make it clear that we're living with the effects of this notion of race. We're living with high rates of poverty, concentrated poverty, disparities between blacks and whites in education and health care. Those realities are with us today, but they are the result not of biological differences between black people and white people. There are none. I mean, whatever differences there are superficial differences in appearance. The effects of racial ideologies are have been horrific, and as I say, they remain with us today. I think if you asked if I had, you know, second thoughts about talking about the myth of race, I want to make it clear that I'm talking about an idea that there are substantial differences in intelligence, in character, and so forth between blacks and whites. That is a myth. That is a myth. But that idea has persisted throughout American history because we continue to use the word race. And I think if there's anything provocative in the book, it's my call for thinking twice about using the word race. It's often a shorthand for these historic differences or for these historic patterns of discrimination. But by continuing to use the word, I think we make concrete what is not concrete at all, what is a fiction, what is a myth.
Jacqueline Jones is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, and she is the author of the book, A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. You can join our discussion about the progression of people of color in America and their relations with white people in America, not in racial terms. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Jacqueline Jones and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is University of Texas History Professor Jacqueline Jones. She is the author of the book, A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America, about how so many times things that we've attributed to one race or the other, saying they're biologically this or biologically that, well, we're all human beings, and she uses several different stories throughout American history to illustrate the point. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jacqueline, as I read through the intro here in the book, it looks like race has been something of a fluid term through the years anyway. It sounds like there have been different groupings and regroupings and some ebbing and flowing of definitions.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the history of the term race and its uses. Those uses have been fluid depending on a particular time and place. That's why I look at six individuals throughout American history. To answer the question, in any particular time and place, who benefits from these ideas of racial differences? I don't think there's a primal prejudice at work here. I think it's very much a product of political context in any particular place. So, yes, these stories show that this is a malleable term, that what we're really talking about here, I think, are stereotypes. So in the early colonies, the stereotype of people of African descent and other bound laborers, indentured servants, was that they were dangerous. They were very dangerous. They were promiscuous and so forth. By the antebellum period, slave owners in the South are saying that all black people are very childlike and very dependent on whites. So we see these stereotypes shift over time, and again, they have political uses. Certain people are benefiting from these stereotypes.
So, and this is really then, as you point out, power relations. It's not so much about color as about I've got the upper hand and you don't. And from what you're talking about just now with some of the ways that they were that African Americans are characterized through the years, it sounds like this is not a group of people outside of that group who really made much of an effort to know the people within that group.
Well, yes, and again, if a group benefits from these racial mythologies, then they'll pursue them, they'll promote them. But it's clear that these are contingent ideas and that different groups of people have different notions that they promote at any particular time. I look at, for instance, antebellum Rhode Island and find there that these ideas do seem to be mutually contradictory. In other words, whites say, well, all black people are poor, they're dependent, they're going to be a charge on the public coffers, But at the same time, black people, they say, are very aggressive in wanting good jobs and wanting their rights. And again, those two ideas exist at the same time, but they seem to be contradictory. And I just want to emphasize one thing you said, and that is, yes, these are matters of power relations. These are a matter of power relations. If we look throughout much of American history, African Americans did not have full and equal rights. They could not vote. They were not the constituency of any particular political party, and that made them vulnerable. And I think the major theme of my book is that when a particular people are vulnerable, then they are more easily exploited. That vulnerability means a lack of rights, a lack of opportunity, and so forth. So, yes, definitely these are power relations, not what some people call race relations.
So, Jacqueline, when you were trying to set up some framework for the book, did you go looking for periods of history and find the people, the six people, to help you tell the story, or did you find the six people and realize that they were the ones who helped exemplify their time and place?
Well, actually, I encountered almost all of these people as a result of my previous work in American history. I've written several books on African-American labor history, and in the course of writing those books, I encountered some really interesting people that I thought deserved more attention than I could give them at the time. So this book gave me a chance to go back to those individuals and to use their stories as a lens into a particular time and place to see how these mythologies of race affected various groups of people.
And you begin with Antonio, no other name given, in 1656 Maryland. Do we know much more about him than his name and the circumstances of his death?
Yes, we know where he came from, the Congo-Angola region of Africa. We know the ship that brought him to the colonies. He landed in New Amsterdam. That was New York City, and then was brought to Maryland. I look at the court case that surrounded his owner, a Dutch merchant named Simon Overzee, who murdered Antonio, killed him in the course of correcting or disciplining him. So I do know a great deal of detail about the trial and the surrounding story. I use that chapter, though, to illustrate that no one during this period in Maryland that I can find was really talking about race, that race was a factor in enslaving Africans. What was a factor was that these are very vulnerable people who are sold into slavery in their native country, and then once they are brought to the colonies, they lack any group that can rescue or redeem them. In contrast, for instance, to Native Americans, certainly the early colonists were eager to find cheap labor wherever they could get it, and there was some effort to enslave natives, but the natives were organized into confederations or nations, and they were armed. So they were not particularly good candidates for enslavement. Just because once an Indian was enslaved, he could be rescued by others of his group nearby.
Well, this is a really eye-opening part of the book, is to realize that the reason that Africans were enslaved was because they really had nobody to protect them. And as you point out, not only Native Americans, but when you stop to think about, well, why didn't they take people from other parts of the world? It's because those people generally had protectors.
Yes, I think that here again we have to remember this is an Atlantic world. It's a world of colliding sea empires. The Portuguese, the Dutch, the English, the French, the Spanish are all vying for colonies and for labor throughout this Atlantic world. And they're able, these empires, often to protect their citizens regardless of where they are. And African nations, nation states, cultural groups had no presence on the high seas in the Atlantic world, making their people so vulnerable in this system.
Jacqueline Jones is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, history professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Her book is A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. We've just started talking about Antonio, the first of six people who are mentioned in the book, people who represent treatment of people of color in the United States and its precursor colonies from the 17th century forward. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacqueline Jones.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to hear the author speak about the development of dog whistle politics, which are implicitly racist rather than the explicit racism we had in like the 40s with the Dixiecrats, in the 50s where we had people like Lester Maddox and his axe handle, and the Southern strategy that then introduced dog whistle politics of racism and Richard Nixon, and has continued on to the present day. In the 2012 election, we had Mitt Romney referring to the 47% as being takers. So I'd like to hear the author's ideas on that.
All right, thank you, Anne.
Well, certainly it is true that overt expressions of racial prejudice are not looked upon kindly in our public discourse today. That's a fact. But it is true that much of this prejudice is coded. In other words, certain words do evoke these prejudices of the past and of the present. The caller suggested the term takers. I would go further and say when President Obama was called the food stamp president, that was meant to evoke people who were dependent, people who were not working, buying into these very ancient stereotypes.
And so, that was Newt Gingrich's term, we should point out.
Yes, yes, exactly. And also President Obama's birth certificate, you know, the idea that he was not a real American. I mean, these are people who are very uncomfortable, I think, with a changing country, a changing society. Diversity is the hallmark of our society, and a lot of people are very uncomfortable with that, I think. And these are loaded terms, coded terms that people use to express their anxiety, their fear that power is slipping from white men exclusively, I think.
Do you think, though, that those terms are used in ways to make sure that they evoke an image of African Americans? I mean, when Newt Gingrich says the food stamp president, I mean, is he trying to evoke an image of African Americans, or is it just poor people generally? Does he really care that much how people interpret it? Is it really up to the receiver rather than the sender? And for that matter, when President Reagan said welfare queen, and was he quite clear on the image he was going to evoke?
Yes. Well, I think this is a cynical manipulation of the term, what Mr. Gingrich meant. I think he was certainly buying into this notion that disproportionate numbers of black people have been dependent on government assistance, although I think if you look today in absolute numbers, there are more whites than blacks using government assistance. But again, this is all very cynical, and it plays into certain people's fears and anxieties. The notion that we're in a post-racial society, I really do object to that term because it suggests that once the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 65 were passed, that prejudice is a thing of the past, that it's really nothing we have to worry about, when in fact the structural legacies of the myth of race are very much with us today in our social division of labor, in our residential patterns, and so forth.
Let us take another call. We have Richard in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacqueline Jones, the author of A Dreadful Deceit.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment that Berry Gordy Jr. and former President Jimmy Carter are second cousins.
Really?
Yes, they had the same great-grandfather.
Okay, and was that because I had mentioned something about the first president with African roots, with Barack Obama?
No, it's just that it's puzzling to me why in the 21st century in America, people, white people in particular, have difficulty acknowledging that there are many, many so-called black people and so-called white people who are closely related to one another.
All right. Thanks for that, Richard. Appreciate it. Which brings up the story of Strom Thurmond, the late senator, and the fact that it was revealed after his death, wasn't it, that he'd had a... No, wait, that's right. That was actually admitted during his lifetime, but after he left the Senate, right?
Yes. His daughter came forward, Essie Mae Washington, to say that she was Strom Thurmond's daughter. Thomas Jefferson had a black family as well. I mean, the caller is certainly right that these terms, black and white, are very arbitrary. They're misleading. They posit a duality. You know, you're either black or white. When we live in a country where people's heritage is very mixed, and these dualities, these dichotomies, really don't apply. It's fascinating to look at Southern families and to see how intertwined people of African and European descent are in those families. Again, it's something that's not often talked about, but it goes against our notion that the world can be divided into black and white.
We have an email here from Tim in Eureka. He says, your guest is right on. Race is a myth that plays on fears that are useful to fuel political and economic tensions. The Human Genome Project has debunked race as a scientific term. In fact, we all seem to have common genetic ancestry. In fact, it is not scientifically impossible that much of all human DNA came from three brothers, which sounds like a reference to the Sons of Noah.
Yes, well, I do think that certainly the science confirms that there is no such thing as race. But the irony here is that what we call scientific racism emerged in the late 19th century and was presumably based on observation, on study, on experimentation. People in this country and in Europe as well, social scientists presumably found so-called racial differences among groups, and then they listed races in a hierarchy. Some were superior in terms of their civilization, some were inferior. So the relation between science and this notion of race is a fascinating one over time, I think.
Which makes it really interesting to think about. We can look back at people saying, well, you know, this race is better than that race. You know, they're just genetically superior, and be shocked and surprised and think, oh, my God, what were they thinking? But the fact is that in today's world, when people say, well, these people tend to be X, whoever these people are, whatever X is, you're still making a racial generalization.
Yes, and we have to get away with stereotyping or generalizing about whole groups of people. I found, again, in the early 19th century in the North, many whites say, well, black people are naturally poor. They're naturally dependent. And, of course, they were talking about a group of people who had recently been freed from slavery and had no access to education, to larger economic opportunities. So whites construct these barriers, political, legal barriers to black people, and then turn around and say that poverty and distress are the natural condition of the people who suffer from these barriers.
I want to come back to the story of Antonio. He's the first person that you profile in A Dreadful Deceit, and he's the slave who was beaten to death essentially by his owner in 1656 Maryland. Simon Overzay was the owner. The more we learn about him, the less we understand his actions, it seems.
Well, it is a mystery, and that's, I think, what makes the story so intriguing. It's impossible to find all the answers in the evidence. But we do know that Simon Overzay was a very young man, very aggressive. He was a risk taker. He was a merchant who owned ships and engaged in transatlantic trade. He came back one day and found one of his slaves, Antonio, who refused to work. He was only newly arrived in the colony of Maryland. He was certainly suffering from some kind of traumatic distress, this man Antonio. And in the course of trying to punish Antonio, trying to make him work, Oversea killed him. And the trial is fascinating because the question is not, isn't it odd that he was acquitted? The question is, why was this man Oversea tried at all?
All right, well, let's come back to that in just a moment. We have to take a break. Jacqueline Jones is our guest. Her book is A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. Back with Jacqueline and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is University of Texas History Professor Jacqueline Jones. Her book, her latest book, is A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. It takes a look at various vignettes in American history through six different people who Jacqueline profiles the major impacts they had on race relations. Obviously, with the subtitle The Myth of Race, there's a big question about race in general and the fact that there is no genetic basis to it. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the issues that stem from those times and continue to this day. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, 1656 Maryland, the slave Antonio refuses to work. His owner, Simon Oversea, beats him to death, essentially, and is tried by jury. And you were just starting to say what the result was.
Well, certainly the owner was acquitted. But there's a very complicated story about why that was the case, why he was even brought to trial. Again, each of these chapters is a lens onto a larger issue. For that chapter and the chapter after, which features Boston King, a fugitive slave, I argue that these slave owners are really not talking in racial terms. They're looking for cheap, exploitable labor. This is a calculated decision, not what one historian called at one point an unthinking decision. And I look at the political and economic dynamics that emerge there. The other chapters, one looks at a savvy black businesswoman in Providence in the early 19th century. One looks at a black man who looked white, Richard White, in Savannah in the late 19th century. A black man who founded a mini Tuskegee, a small industrial institute for blacks in Mississippi in 1903. And finally, Simon P. Owens, who was an auto worker in Detroit in the 20th century.
And then we talked earlier about these people that you'd come across in earlier research, and they do a good job of helping describe certain periods in history in the book. You'd mentioned a couple of references to early 19th century New England, and that's the Eleanor Eldridge story, and she lived in Providence, Rhode Island, and other places in the area. It starts, though, with this destruction, essentially, of a neighborhood called Hardscrabble in Providence. Who destroyed it and why?
Yes, that was a dramatic story. This is a group of white men who gathered to tear down a whole neighborhood. It was a small neighborhood of ramshackle houses called Hardscrabble. It was a place where poor people lived and drank and made merry when they could, sailors, day laborers, and so forth. And the whites in Providence characterized this as an entirely black neighborhood. It was not. There were poor whites there as well. But they said they were on a moral mission to rid the city of this pestilent place where poor people engaged in illicit and immoral activities. In fact, it is more complicated than that, and this is a group of white men who are really acting out their anxieties about a very dramatic change in the city of Providence, the emergence of new kinds of jobs, railroad jobs, factory jobs. White men who are worried that they're going to lose their skills at this particular point in time, that their children are going to be working in factories and not able to attend the public schools. So there's a great deal of anxiety in the city, and the destruction of Hardscrabble is reflective of that anxiety. And against again, racial mythologies are invoked to justify this violence.
So when we look now through these first three vignettes, you mentioned Boston King briefly, Antonio, Eleanor Eldridge, and describe the fact that slavery was less about race than just about the ability to take people who had no other protectors and put them into bondage. We're left with this impression that a lot of people did not even think about things in terms of race until there was an issue where people began to get out of what their traditional boundaries were. So when, for example, you've got white workers who want certain jobs, but black workers are getting them, suddenly they get a handle by which to identify these people as an other.
Yes. In fact, I say at one point, race is a rationale, but it's also a reaction. It's a reaction to black people pursuing equal rights, pursuing good jobs. Whites begin to concoct this notion of race in order to justify keeping black people subordinate. So we see that happen in the antebellum South. Slave owners, you know, are not really that concerned about notions of race, it seems to me, through much of the 18th century. But when abolitionists in the North and Europe begin to say, hey, there's something really wrong going on here in this new country, that we could have the institution of human bondage, then we see notions of racial difference take hold. And I would say that Thomas Jefferson is key in this development, too. On the one hand, the author of the Declaration of Independence. On the other hand, a slave owner himself who has a vested interest in justifying the exclusion of black men from the body politic. And he begins to experiment with ideas, this notion of racial difference, in a book he wrote called Notes on the State of Virginia in the early 1780s, the idea that somehow black people were very different from whites. They had no imagination. They could not write poetry or engage in higher mathematical pursuits. And, of course, his observations there are based on his own enslaved population at Monticello. He's making generalizations based on that group of people who are kept in slavery.
Which boggles the mind to this day that he could keep two clearly contradictory sets of thoughts going on, because, of course, he bore children with Sally Hemings.
Yes, and he lived a very complicated life, certainly. On the one hand, in his public pronouncements, at times he would say he thought slavery was wrong, that he feared the black population. He said these are people who have good reason to hate their owners, white people in general. On the other hand, he was a very stern master at Monticello. He was determined to make that plantation pay. He had spent a lot of money on the main house. He was often in debt. And he's very calculating when it comes to getting enslaved people to work hard, even children. Of course, he depends on their labor in the fields as well. So he's a complicated figure, to be sure.
Coming back to Eleanor Eldridge then in Providence in the 1820s then and beyond, she was a fairly savvy businesswoman, as you pointed out already. So being black and a woman, I mean, what reputation did she get from not only being a savvy business person, but also from not backing down when she was confronted by white men?
She's a very interesting person because she really belies all these stereotypes of black people in Providence at the time, the idea that blacks are dependent or, on the one hand, are overly aggressive, on the other hand. She made her way, though, and made her money by having white patrons, by taking advantage of the white women and men who employed her and getting them to help her pay her legal fees. One of her white employers helped her write her memoir, which is a fascinating book, but it goes to show that black people who really wanted to make a way in the world in this time and place needed a white patron, because certainly the legal system was very much against them.
We have an email here from Joe in Talent, Oregon. He says, I was blessed with the opportunity to raise three black brothers along with my own five white Irish kids and got an amazing education and insight into the state of racism in America. I raised them in Florida, and the divide between white, brown, and black was distinct and ingrained among my peers. The N-word was used casually in conversation, even when folks found out three of my kids were black. Thankfully, the younger generation and the opportunity to grow up in the same house blurred those lines for them, and I'm proud of how colorblind they are. For them, watching with pride the term of the first African-American president play out is colored by the outright racism that came to the surface over the past 6 years. We often joke that we should allow the right wing one day to use the N-word without retribution when talking about Obama and get it out of their system so we can start to move forward as a united country. The days of white domination are over. Better to accept it and work with it than continue to fight it and become marginalized. Again, that from Joe and Talent. Your thoughts, Jacqueline?
Well, that's a compelling story, personal story, and political statement as well. So I don't have much to add.
All right, I want to come back to one of the earlier chapters in the Boston King, who was born a slave in South Carolina. But at the near the end of his story, we learn about some of the rules and laws in the early United States of America, including the Naturalization Act of 1790. What did this spell out for the new country?
Well, yes, it held that only free white men could become naturalized citizens. And so we see very early on this network of laws, this scaffolding of laws and institutions that will continue to make people of African descent vulnerable. And in this regard, it is important to recognize that when I say people of African descent, I'm talking about people often of mixed parentage. I mean, certainly we call President Obama African American, even though he has had a white mother and a black father, suggesting and reminding us, I think, that these are cultural terms. They have to do with identity, but they have also been legal terms, of course, defined in the most bizarre ways by drops of blood and so forth. Under slavery, it was the children of an enslaved woman who were considered slaves, and regardless of their color. There are comments on travelers in the antebellum South in these plantations, light-haired, blue-eyed slaves. These are obviously the offspring of forced unions between the master and an enslaved woman. So things are much more messy and much more complicated, but we still continue to use this word race as if it has real meaning.
Let's take another call. We have Daryl in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Jacqueline Jones is the author of A Dreadful Deceit.
Hello. Wonderful discussion, and I'm certainly going to order the book. My question, I know there were cases of blacks owning whites, I think even in Georgia, to a certain point until it was outlawed. My question is, when did this evolve, if evolve is the word, from a question of property into a question of race? When did race enter into it, and whether or not the author has knowledge of that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daryl. Appreciate it. Jacqueline?
Well, blacks owning whites, there were very, very few white people in early colonial America who were technically enslaved. Certainly many whites were indentured servants. That's another form of bound labor. But it is a legal process. Early in Virginia, for instance, the father's status determined the status of the child. But the problem with that was when a master impregnated his slave, then the child would be free because the master was free. So Virginia took steps to change that and to make sure that the status of the child flowed from the status of the mother, on the assumption that white men would be sexually abusing black women and that their children should remain enslaved. So this does become a legal system based on the status of the mother in all cases. And as I said, it has nothing really to do with race per se, because these are children of mixed parentage. They're neither black nor white. But their legal status is fixed nonetheless, according to the status of the mother.
Jacqueline, how would you like to see people use the book? What should be the takeaway that would most satisfy you in the way that we move forward with the information you provide here?
I think I would be most satisfied if people began to think twice about using the word race. In other words, we use it casually today. It's possible to see headlines and news stories about racial differences in education, in healthcare, in jobs. Those aren't really racial differences. Those are differences that are the product of historic forces. They have nothing to do with biological determinism one way or another. But because we continue to use this word race, we, I think, continue to suggest to ourselves that race is real. Race as a biological factor is real, when in fact we're talking about power relations, social constructs, and not about biology at all. So, again, I know it's difficult. People have expressed some skepticism that we can ever get away from the word race. In the book, I often put it in quotation marks as a reminder that I don't think it is real, although the consequences certainly of belief in race are very real. But I guess I would just like to see a little more self-scrutiny in when people use that word race.
The book is called The Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. Jacqueline Jones wrote it, and she's been our guest. Jacqueline, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about leasing BLM lands for wind and solar projects. We'll talk about Oregon being one of the number one states for attracting new residents, and then we'll talk about Oregon's health insurance experiment. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and at the controls today, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.